I like that song, Everything. It reminds me of the promise of Christ before he left when he said, remember, I am with you always, everything, everywhere. Christ has been with you this winter while you were shoveling your driveway. I hope you knew that. Out for a walk, in the grocery store, doing the laundry, looking after the kids, reading your Bible, praying, embracing a friend, a spouse, everything, always, everywhere. That's part of the reward, thanks to the risk that he took. It's great. I like that. And the book of Ruth is a great place, I think, to substantiate so many of those ideas. Yahweh, Israel's God, is the God of the ordinary and the everyday. So often we look for what's special. What are we doing today that'll be really special? And then you find out, well, there's actually just a lot of the ordinary and the everyday. There's errands that have to be run. The garbage has to be taken out. God is in the ordinary and the everyday. He actually makes it special. He makes it holy. Taking the garbage out becomes a holy exercise. It's making your wife happy. You're using the strength that you have. It's good. It's not just coming to church and having communion that's holy. All of life becomes holy, special, set apart, because we're not alone. He's there with us. We haven't even got to the sermon yet. So last week we talked about a day to remember, and I promised you that this Sunday we'd talk about a night to remember. So you know, day, night, it just kind of goes together real nicely. And we're in the book of Ruth, and there's all sorts of names and places and ideas, and I thought that sort of collage kind of brings all of that stuff together really nice. Two of the sort of heroes or heroines of the book are Ruth and Naomi, and I got a picture. Archaeologists found this snapshot. I don't know if they really look like that, but it's kind of a neat picture. It just sort of brings out the chronological space between a young, attractive, a more mature woman, and there they are side by side, doing life together, caring for each other, looking out for one another, being faithful, being responsible, being people of duty. That's another thing that is holified by Jesus, doing your duty. You know, you get points for doing your duty as a Christian person. One of the special moments, perhaps one of the most memorable moments of my life, was the day that I proposed to Diane. We got up early. We were both living in Edmonton. She had a house on the south side, and I lived way as far north as you could go and still be in Edmonton. And so we got up early, and we headed to Jasper, which was one of our favorite haunts. And when we got there, we took a little hike up a hill, kind of a big hill that's called Old Fort Point. And we've been hiking that for we had hiked it a number of times. I've been hiking it all my life. And we climbed up to the top, probably huffing and puffing a little bit when we got there. And then we found this, I think that there's a slide of this. Yeah, there's a view from partway up Old Fort Point overlooking Jasper and the town site as well as some of the surrounding area. And we got to the top, and we found a rocky outcropping, close to the edge, actually. A little risky. I thought that was appropriate for what was about to happen. I asked Diane if she would marry me, and she said yes. I must have been pretty euphoric, because later on that day, we went swimming in Lake Annette, which isn't far from Jasper Park Lodge. I've never stayed there. I just go in the lobby and hang around with rich people, but it wasn't too far from Jasper Park Lodge. And so we went swimming, and after I jumped into the water, I realized I still had my keyless entry for my car in my pocket. So scrambled out and took it apart and tried to dry it out, and it's still working over a decade later. So we were being looked after that day. That was one of my more memorable days in my life, and maybe proposal was a memorable time for you. It'd be interesting for you and your spouse to just talk about what do you remember and what do you remember and what's different and what's the same. Well, Ruth chapter 3 is about proposal. This is a memorable proposal. All proposals are memorable, but this one especially. is memorable. Boy, this one was risky. And we'll talk about that today. Ruth, assisted by her mother-in-law, Naomi, created a memorable proposal. A German Old Testament theologian by the name of Hermann Gunkel, they always have funny names, those German theologians, he didn't think that much of the book of Ruth. He didn't think there was much of a religious moral in the book. But he got pressed one day, well, if there was a religious moral to the book, what do you think it would be? Well, I don't really think there is one. But if I had to give a moral of the book of Ruth, he said it would be something like, men, watch out for these women. They'll get you yet. I don't know if you agree with Hermann, but that's what he thought. You'll remember last day as we looked at Ruth chapter 2, it began on the note of coincidence. And we use the word coincidence in the sense that there were factors at work in the situation that were beyond the control of humans. And Ruth wanted to go out and find some work so she could get some food for her and her mother-in-law, doing her duty, being a responsible daughter-in-law, and out she goes. As it turns out, she lands in a field that belonged to one of their relatives, a Boaz, a man who was considered a near relative, and as such, according to social custom and biblical tradition, he was required to look after them and to care for them. So this really got Naomi's hopes up, I'm sure. But right at the end of chapter 2, we find out that Ruth continued to work for Boaz in his field, you know, for the duration of harvest, but nothing was happening. Nothing was moving forward. It's like things were on pause. What's wrong with this, you know, Boaz guy? Like, you know, can't he see opportunity in front of him? Like, strike the iron while it's hot. But nothing seems to be moving. And this is where chapter 3 picks up, because Naomi develops a scheme to try to bring this man to a better place. He doesn't seem to be making any moves, and we don't know why that was. I mean, maybe he was just a sensitive guy. Maybe he just realized that Ruth was in mourning still. She'd just lost her husband and her father-in-law, and so, you know, we don't want to rush into anything. Perhaps she needs time for emotional healing. But Naomi was of the opinion that the time for healing is over. It's time to move on. And so she concocts this scheme in verses 1 through 5. And this is what the scheme consisted of in chapter 3. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you, where you will be well provided for. Now Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, take or note the place where he is lying, then go and uncover his feet or his legs and lie down. He will tell you what to do. I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. So the first thing that we see here as this plan begins to take shape is that it arises out of a sense of duty. Some of the translations actually bring out the Hebrew a little better here. It's a rhetorical question. And you could translate it something like, "My daughter, shouldn't I be the one to find a home for you where you will be well provided for?" And the answer, rhetorical question here, the answer is, "Of course." And so some of the translations have just translated it as an affirmation, which is what it means. But more literally, it just brings out this, shouldn't I be doing something for you? Shouldn't I be helping you? Shouldn't I be finding a husband for you? So we see that, you know, Ruth or Naomi has this sense of social and religious obligation. Reminds me a bit of the movie Fiddler on the Roof. Maybe you've seen the musical. I'd recommend you see it about a dozen times. I mean, this is really good. And there's that one point where this lady, who's the designated matchmaker, she's got this great little tune that she sings, "Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match, find me a catch." And she really felt driven by this sense to, you know, link people up. And it worked well in their culture in their day. Don't know that it would work as well today, but I think there's still a fair amount of matchmaking that does go on. Wouldn't you say? Maybe you have a sister who's tried to match you with somebody, or a mother, I don't know. I find it interesting that when Naomi gets to this point where she concocts this this plan. It's like the roles are starting to change. Remember in chapter 1 of Ruth, it was Ruth who was standing up for her mother-in-law, right? She left her homeland. She went to Naomi's country. She embraced her religion. She was looking out for and going to look after Naomi. But now the shoe slips onto the other foot. And now Naomi is the one showing initiative, and she's going to look out for her daughter-in-law. Kind of interesting how that happens. I remember reading a story by Irma Bombeck, the well-known newspaper columnist. I don't know if they have ever run her stuff here in Red Deer. Probably at one time they would have. And Irma describes the time she was out with her mother, who was getting on in years, and they were running errands. And at one point she had to break rather quickly, and she instinctively put her arm out so that her, you know, mother didn't make for the dash. And she realized at that moment, wow, our roles are starting to change here. This is the sort of thing Mom would have done for me not that many years ago, and now she's doing it for Mom. So here in the book of Ruth, we see some changes going on in the roles that they have with one another. And then we see the details of the scheme. It arises out of a sense of duty. And then we see the details of the scheme. Her plan actually leaves a lot to chance. And again, when we use the word chance, we mean she leaves a lot to outside forces that are beyond their control. There's a number of things here about her plan that we should note. One is that she assumed that Boaz would share their sense of duty. She mentions that he's their relative. And in their culture, it was the responsibility of a near relative to come to the aid of another relative when they're in a jam. It could be economic or otherwise. That was the expectation. So she's assuming here that he will share their sense of duty. And then, like any good mother-in-law, she's good at collecting intelligence. She collects appropriate information to help her plan along. She kind of knows where Boaz will be. And when he's going to be there, and that's all a critical part of her scheme. He will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. I think I have a picture of a threshing floor. The threshing floor was an area where they would just dump all the stalks that they had cut down. Then they would get an animal. If we go to the next slide, a number of years ago we were in Ethiopia visiting a friend of ours who was doing mission work in and around Addis Ababa. And we're driving along, and I saw this scene, and I said, stop. I saw these two different scenes. And in this one, a guy, he's got the stick, and these cattle are going in a circle. And they're trampling, they're treading out the grain. And just the action of their feet on the grain would separate. And then in the second one, and there's a guy with a pitchfork, and he's throwing up, all of the hay and, or the I'm not a farmer, you can tell, but all of the stuff. He throws it up in there, and you can see the wind carrying some of the chaff away. So there's the treading of grain, and there's winnowing. And this is the kind of work that Boaz would have been doing. And it's pretty neat stuff. So her plan was based on intelligence. Thirdly, her scheme involved good grooming for the right effect. You women, you know all about this. Guys, sometimes not so much. I want you to bathe. I want you to get some perfume. Some of the Hebrew manuscripts actually describe the perfume as myrrh, and we're a little suspicious that maybe it was just an overeager scribe over the years who wanted to juice things up a little bit. But I do happen to have a bottle of myrrh here that I got from Harold and Jeanette when they came back from the Holy Land recently. Haven't tried it yet. My wife hasn't put it on yet, but apparently this was pretty expensive, like Chanel No. 5 stuff in the olden days. So Ruth, you know, she got herself really cleaned up nicely, has the perfume on, and she puts her best clothes on. And she's doing this for a reason. Now, you know, several thousand years later, we're thinking, now what was the statement that she was trying to make? Obviously, she's trying to make a statement. And the thing about statements is you can understate them or you can overstate them. It can be a little bit tricky. And if you don't know the kind of character that these people embodied, you might misunderstand the statement, right? And some commentators have done this. They've sort of accused Naomi and Ruth as, boy, you know, she's out there trolling tonight. She is going to get her man. And they even embellish it a little more beyond that. That doesn't seem to be what's going on here. But she is grooming for the right effect. One of my Old Testament professors, who now teaches at Wheaton College, where our own Elaine Nordby graduated from. She's a smart lady. My professor has written an award-winning commentary on Ruth, and I've learned so much about Ruth reading it. And one of the things that he reminds us is that in those days, mourning was an important social place that you were in. If somebody dies, you marked mourning by wearing certain kinds of clothing. There were garments of widowhood, for example. And we read about that in different parts of the Bible. And he suggests that perhaps Ruth had been wearing garments of widowhood. And she would have worn them to the field. And everybody would have known that she was in mourning. And it's kind of a signal, too, to guys, stay away. I'm not ready yet to move ahead with my life. But it sounds like, if Dan Block is right, and it makes good sense, if this, in fact, is what's happening, it's like she's saying to her daughter-in-law, you know what? It's time to remove your garments of mourning. It's time to put on normal clothing. It's time, actually, to put on the kind of clothing that reflects that you are ready to move on with your life. And for you, part of that will mean getting remarried. That makes good sense. So part of the plan involved grooming for the right effect. It also involved that she lurk a bit, skulk a bit, don't be seen too soon. You know, wait till this guy, and, you know, they describe what Boaz will have been up to. He's, you know, he's had a busy day, and he's had a good meal, and he's had a beverage. And it probably wasn't 7-Up. Probably was an alcoholic beverage. Nobody's saying that he was inebriated, but he was feeling good. The next section says that he was feeling good, and he's going to lie down. He's going to go down to sleep, and that's when you show up. And the next part of the plan, I think, entailed leaving Ruth somewhat vulnerable. This is not a... By the way, don't anybody here get dating tips from this passage. That's not what the point is. But Naomi, I think, by her advice, leaves Ruth vulnerable. She's in a secluded place with an older man. He's had a little bit to drink. You know, he's euphoric. And it sounds a little risky to me. Her body language will be ambiguous. And will he read, will he get the signals right? Men aren't known particularly for getting the signals well that women are trying to send them. And so this is the advice. The expectation is that Naomi and Ruth are going to trust each other, including Boaz. They're going to trust one another to act in good faith. And that's a big part of life, isn't it? We often do that. We get into situations where we just trust that the other person and ourselves will be acting in good faith. Not many months ago, Diane and I purchased a home from Howard Betty Northey. It was kind of an unusual sale in the sense that we hadn't sold our place in Edmonton yet, and obviously the seller wants to sell it as quickly as possible. We were pleasantly surprised and blessed when Howard gave us a rather long possession date. And, of course, that gave us time to complete our affairs in Edmonton so that we could finish the deal here. And so there was an acting in good faith. I've never been involved in a house sale where the seller was so generous to us because he even let us bring tradesmen in. We were doing some flooring changes and painting, and he let us do that. And I really felt like we were able to act in good faith. That's what's happening here. They are going to trust each other to be responsible, to be faithful, to be godly, to be people of good character. Well, what happened? Verses 6 through 15, we've just read the scheme, the plan. On paper, it looked good. But how well did it execute? And in verses 6 through 15, the rendezvous takes place. And the first thing that happens is Ruth has to play her part. And she plays her part well. She executes well. Let's read that, 6 through 9. So she, Ruth, went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet or his legs, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. It's understandable that he would be startled. It's cold at night. His legs were uncovered. And so he woke up, probably was groping around, trying to find his mantle so that he could cover up again. And, there's another person. And judging from the smell of possibly myrrh, it was a woman. What are you going to do? Remember the period that this is in? The period of the judges? You remember what the period of the judges was characterized by? Everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. Most Israelite men couldn't be trusted in a situation like this. They would have been all too happy to have a female come visit them in the dead of night. It would have been a no-brainer. What about Boaz? What will he do? It's like he's on trial here in this story. Well, Ruth takes her position on cue. And then in verses 8 through 9, I should keep reading here. So in the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. She was right where she was supposed to be. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. So she identifies herself. Here comes the proposal. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." Now, in ancient language, this is one of the ways that you proposed. Earlier in the book, I think it was in chapter 2, reference was made to Ruth coming under the wings of the Lord, coming under the protection of God. And the word there for wing and the word here for corner is the same term. So the idea of protection is prevalent. And she is asking if she might come under the husbandly protection that marriage would afford her. "Will you marry me?" is what she's saying. And then she reminds him that he has this social and legal obligation. "You are a guardian redeemer of our family." Wow. This is risky. She's a woman. He's a man. He's an Israelite. She's a Moabite. In the employment arrangement that they have, he's her superior. She is his subordinate. Like, this is not how it's supposed to work. She's really going out on a limb here. And then she has the gall to remind him that he has a social and legal responsibility. How is he going to take this? Well, I'm sure that most of us have been in relationships or situations where we have put ourselves out there. I don't know how this is going to work out. You know, maybe you got to ask for a raise or something. And you go in there when your boss is in good spirits. Maybe he just had lunch. Who knows what he was drinking. And you just think this would be a good time to float the idea. I remember the very first time that I told Diane how I felt about her. This is before our engagement. We were having lunch, and it was actually a working lunch because we were both involved in a mission trip that our church was running. I was pastor in the church. Diane was a congregant in the church, and we had been working together on this mission trip. The whole experience for me was really pleasant. I was really enjoying it, and I was starting to develop feelings for Diane, and I thought, wow, am I going to say something or what? And I thought, you know what? And I hadn't slept the night before. This was going through my mind. And so we sat down and we had lunch. And then I took out my heart and I set it before her and I started to fess up. And I didn't know what she was going to do. Is she going to blow me off? Silly man. Was she going to overreact? As it turned out, she was very gracious to me. And the rest is history. But there are times, there are situations where we put ourselves out there with someone who could turn us down, somebody who could hurt us, right? And Boaz could have done that. Silly woman, you know, or maybe take advantage of her. We don't know. It's secluded. It's dark. What did he do? Verses 10 through 15. Let's read that. "The Lord bless you. Yahweh bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character." So he begins to show his colors, right? And he's quite congenial. "I hear what you're saying. It's good. It's good with me. I'm agreeable. I like the idea. This works for me. You have been so kind." He praises her. "You were kind to your mother-in-law when you came to Bethlehem. And now you're offering me. I'm an older guy. I mean, you could have much younger men. What do you want with a guy like me? But I like the idea, and I'll do what I can." But then in verses 12 and 13, he reminds her, though, that he is a man of integrity. "Although it is true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good. Let him redeem you. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning." He presents himself as a man who understands that there are parameters that society sometimes sets, that scripture and biblical tradition sets for us. And I want to work within those parameters, he says. I have some obligations. I have some responsibilities. I'm a duty man. I want to do this, but I want to do it right. And so there's this little legal finagle that we're going to have to deal with. I'm a near redeemer. I'm a near relative, but I'm not the nearest. So there's another guy, and we've got to sort things out with him. And if he's not willing to do it, I'm your man. But we got to see what'll happen. Challenging circumstances often reveal our mettle, what we're made of. Sometimes you don't know what you or another person is made of until you go through a trial, a bit of a test, and you have to make a decision and a choice, and your decision and choice shows you for who you really are. Recently saw the movie Monument Men. Great storyline. Second World War, and the Nazis have been pilfering museums across Europe. They've been stealing this priceless art, these art treasures, and they've been hiding them in bunkers and mines and different places. And so the Allies put together a team of art experts, and they have to go out and find and recover and then redistribute them to their rightful owners. So the part played by Matt Damon, he's an American, he's an art expert. In his work, he meets a character played by Cate Blanchett. She's, I think, a Belgium museum curator. And this is the last night before he heads back to America. They had some business that they had to finish up. And over dinner, she invites Matt, who's a married man in the film, she invites him to spend the night with her. And I tell you, you can feel the tension. What is he going to do? Is he going to be a good husband? Is he going to be the family man that God wants him to be? Or what? And he makes the right choice. And I wanted to stand up in the theater and just applaud him. But sometimes you don't know what you are made of until your commitments and your values are tested. And that's what happened to Boaz. And he showed himself to be a man who was faithful. And then in verses 16 to 18, Ruth checks in with her mother-in-law. You can be sure that it was a long night for both of them. So when Ruth came to her mother-in-law, I should mention verse 14. Let's finish reading the other section. So she lay down at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. And he said, "No one must know that a woman came to the threshing floor." In other words, you are a woman of virtue. We must not compromise that. I do not want you to lose your good name. So this is how I want you to head back. And then he also said, "Bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out." When she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley. That's a lot. And placed the bundle on her. Then he went back to town. So this is his way of saying, I am so totally for you and for this whole idea, this arrangement. Here is a gift. Bring it back to your mother-in-law. Let her know about it too. So when Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, "How did it go, my daughter?" Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her and added, "He gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, 'Don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" And you remember when Bob Northey was preaching a few weeks ago, chapter 1, Naomi's big complaint, "God has brought me back empty." And now she's getting filled up full. Yeah, it's just one of the clues that they're turning the corner. Things are picking up. Then Naomi said, "Wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today." So, you know, they'd done everything that they could do. All they could do is wait. Sometimes all you can do is wait, right? What are you doing? "Well, I'm just waiting." "Well, what are you waiting for?" "Well, Naomi said, we're going to wait until the matter is settled today. We're going to wait until we find out what happens." Boy, how many times do we find ourselves in that place? All I can do is wait to see what happens, which is another way of saying there are forces at work outside of us. And whatever happens will depend on those forces. If you're a religious person, if you're a person of faith, you will see God in that. If you're not, you will just see blind faith. And of course, these are religious people. They're always referencing God whenever they talk to each other, it says. So for a little take home, the chapter ends with Ruth and Naomi waiting. It's just waiting. And what's going to happen? We don't know. It just kind of leaves us hanging. It's sort of an invitation. And don't forget to read chapter 4. They're waiting to find out what happens. And I dare say that there are many of us today who find ourselves in places where we're waiting. I'm waiting for stuff. You're waiting for stuff. As a church, I'm sure we're waiting for stuff. How's it going to turn out? What's going to happen? What is it while we're waiting that helps us to wait well? Who teaches us to wait well? We all have to wait. It's like the other day I was thinking, We all have to die. Who teaches us to die well? Anybody ever taught you how to die well? Mohan Varghese taught me some things about how to die well. Visited him a few hours before he died. Can you learn how to die well without actually being with somebody who's dying? I don't know. What helps us to wait well? And there are a couple of things, I think. One is, it helps knowing that you have said your prayers. There are so many prayers in this book. People are blessing others in Yahweh's name. They're saying prayers about this, that, and the other thing. It helps to know that you've said your prayers. One of the things that will help you to wait well is to have said your prayers. Maybe there's a time to say, I don't need to pray about this anymore. I have said my prayers, and now I'm just going to have to wait to see what happens. I could imagine that. It helps knowing that you have done what you can do. There are some things that you can do. What are they? Make sure that you've done those, that you've crossed your T's and you've dotted your I's. There are things that you can do. Make sure that you've done them. Banged up my knee a couple of weeks ago. I can't believe how long it's taking me to get an appointment to see a physio, but I think this week I'll see them. It's just, I found it hard waiting. But what has helped is knowing that I've done what I'm supposed to do, putting some heat on it and no swelling. And my wife said, don't put ice on it if it's not swollen. Just put heat on it. So I need to talk to our doctor here about that, make sure we're getting good advice. I went online. It seemed to concur. Make sure that you are doing what you can do. And then what you do is you trust God to help others to act responsibly and faithfully. I sure hope this physio knows what she's doing. I hope she is good. She comes highly recommended. So that's right now that will be the next step. And then the other thing, the final thing is that it helps when you are convinced that God is a God who works in the ordinary and the everyday. If you have a God that doesn't give a lick about the ordinary and the everyday, you are hooped. Because so many of the things that distress us kind of fit under that category. I mean, why would the God of the universe care about my knee? I mean, I'm sure he has much bigger fish to fry. But if there is anything that the story of Ruth teaches us, that our God is a God of the ordinary and the everyday. So we're convinced of that, and we move forward in that confidence.